From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Elaine Pagels is a professor of religion who says we pretend to live in a moral universe where bad things don't happen to good people. After her husband died in a hiking accident, she examined how Western religions deal with loss, personal tragedy, and the force of evil. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss these ideas with Pagels. She's written a new book called The Origin of Satan. Also, we meet Rusty Cundiff, director, co-writer, and co-star of the new urban horror film Tales from the Hood. His previous film, Fear of a Black Hat, spoofed gangster rap. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by saxophonist Carl Denson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says the world no longer faces a despot like Hitler or Stalin, but there are new dangers. Mr. Clinton spoke at today's ceremonies marking the 50th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations. The president says the world body has much more to do, and getting rid of it won't solve new world problems.
Turning our backs on the UN is no solution. It would be short-sighted and self-destructive. It would strengthen the forces of global disintegration. It would threaten the security, the interest, and the values of the American people. So I say especially to the opponents of the United Nations here in the United States, turning our back on the UN and going it alone will lead to far more economic, political, and military burdens on our people in the future and would ignore the lessons of our own history.
UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, who spoke before the president, says the ideas that formed the foundation of the United Nations are not guaranteed to win in today's world. The nation's biggest defense contractor will cut some 12,000 jobs over the next 5 years. Lockheed Martin Corporation wants to save nearly $2 billion a year. The new company was created this year when Lockheed merged with Martin Marietta. The new firm had already announced 7,000 job cuts. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak says Sudan might be involved in the assassination attempt against him today in Ethiopia's capital. Sudanese officials have denied any link. NPR Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Weary-looking, Mubarak told reporters that his government would continue its campaign against Muslim extremist groups that have vowed to overthrow his government. Speaking of the assassination attempt, Mubarak said his motorcade came under fire from the street and from rooftops after tried to pass a car stopped on a street in Addis Ababa. Egyptian and Ethiopian security forces immediately fired back, killing 3 of the 6 attackers. The security forces suffered no casualties, according to the Egyptian government. The nationalities of the assailants were not announced, but Mubarak said they did not look like Ethiopians or other Africans. He did say it was possible that the gunmen came from the Sudan, which has been feuding with Egypt in recent years. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
A published report on the Whitewater matter is backing up what the Clintons have said about their real estate investments. The Wall Street Journal is quoting from a report for the Resolution Trust Corporation. It cites unnamed sources who say the report shows the Clintons were passive investors in Whitewater Development Corporation, and they weren't involved in its finances until 1986, as they've stated. There have been charges against the Clinton that funds transferred from Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan to Whitewater helped the thrift to collapse. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 33 points at 4,552, trading's heavy. The Nasdaq is down 10 points at 928. This is NPR. A challenger has emerged to take on British Prime Minister John Major for the leadership of the ruling Conservative Party. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
John Major shocked the nation last week by resigning as head of the Conservative Tory Party and giving his many critics within the party a chance to challenge him for the leadership. It took several days for a competitor to come forward, but the man who will try to unseat Mr. Major is a member of the Prime Minister's own cabinet, 44-year-old Welsh Secretary John Redwood. Redwood is identified with the so-called Eurosceptic wing of the party, which feels Mr. Major has given up too much of Britain's sovereignty to the European Union. It appears unlikely that the little-known Redwood could actually defeat Major in the first round of leadership voting next week, but even a strong showing by Redwood could open the door for challengers with bigger followings. Since the Tory party holds a majority in Britain's parliament, its leader automatically becomes prime minister. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor is in Geneva again, working to break an auto trade deadlock with Japan. It's getting closer to the Wednesday deadline set by the United States. That's when nearly $6 billion in punitive tariffs could be imposed on 13 models of Japanese luxury cars. The Clinton administration has been trying to force Japan to buy more U.S. cars and car parts. Vice President Al Gore says the U.S. will not be the first to blink in the negotiations. NASA managers are still hoping for a launch tomorrow of the space shuttle Atlantis, but weather forecasters say the odds are against them. The shuttle program's weather officer says there's a 70% chance of bad weather at launch time, which is set for 3:32 p.m. Eastern time. The officer says the rains that have been soaking Cape Canaveral have been unusually heavy, even by Florida summertime standards. Rain and lightning have forced two delays of the first docking flight to the Russian space station, Mir. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Elaine Pagels, is a historian of the ancient world. She's the author of The Gnostic Gospels, which won a National Book Award, and Adam, Eve, and the Serpent. Her intellectual world was shaken by two personal tragedies in the late 1980s. Her six-year-old son died of a respiratory illness. About a year and a half later, her husband died in a hiking accident. She says that after her husband died, she became aware that she was living in the presence of an invisible being. That is, she was living with a vivid sense of someone who had died. During the following years, she began to reflect on the ways that religious traditions give shape to the invisible world, and how our imaginative perceptions of what is invisible shape the ways we respond to events in the natural world. She also found herself reflecting on the ways that people from Greek, Jewish, and Christian traditions deal with misfortune and loss and evil. This led her to write her new book, The Origin of Satan.
When people experience some unexpected misfortune, they often respond as if it's their fault or somebody else's fault or some, you know, the universe's fault or God's fault or something like that. And it struck me, although I'd never believed that, that this is like a cultural reflex, you know, that this conviction that somehow the universe has a moral structure. And when that accident happened and devastated my life, I was married to my late husband for 20 years, and it was quite extraordinary. I found that even though I didn't believe in that, you know, that it was anybody's fault, he was a physicist working on chaos theory at the time, as a matter of fact, certainly knew he didn't believe that. It was just dealing with an unexpected sort of universe. That came up as a kind of cultural reflex, and I found for me it was not helpful. And one thing I had to do with it was to look at the way I had learned culturally this kind of reflex.
What wasn't helpful? What reflex wasn't helpful?
The belief that it was somebody's fault that these things happen. Mm-hmm. And I needed to look at that and put it aside. And one way of doing that was to look at how that view came into our culture. That's one part of it. The book also came out of another kind of very visceral perception, which happens, I'm sure you know, when you suddenly lose someone you love very much, especially someone you're very close to and live with, then it's as though the person is there, but they're not there. It's a very strange perception, and accommodating oneself to that loss is a very long-term process. And when I said I felt as though I were living in the presence of an invisible being, I didn't mean literally that I thought he was, you know, sitting over my shoulder, but simply that I was aware of his presence a great deal and then aware of his absence a great deal. And after that thought, you know, considerably later, I realized that in the ancient world, which I study sort of as a historian, virtually everybody thought that there were invisible beings in the world. Whether you were Egyptian or Greek or Babylonian or Jewish or Christian, almost everyone accepted that.
Now, where does Satan come in and what you were going through emotionally when you decided to write the book?
Well, I think the figure of Satan had to do with conflict, it had to do with distress to some extent, but also had to do with his cultural reflex that, as I said, was not at all useful, which leads a person to think when they have some kind of misfortune like this that you know, that this is an evil thing or something bad is being done to them. And I started out looking at invisible beings, which for me meant the Greek gods, you know, like Hera and Zeus, Apollo, all of those gods. And then thinking that, but a Jew or a Christian wouldn't look at Greek gods. They were thinking about a universe in which there's a moral order, and it's ruled by God and his angels and so forth. Anyway, so I decided to look at the Greek gods and the angels and demons. Then I was very much surprised to discover that demons and devils are almost non-existent in Jewish tradition. They just aren't there until very, very late, almost until the time of the early Christian era.
Satan, the devil kind of is in the Old Testament through the Job story.
Well, there are stories that talk about a character called HaSatan. It means the adversary. It means, but he's not what we think of as a Satan. He's one of the sons of God. He's an angelic being, a servant of God who does things that people don't like. For example, he can block their path. He can be an obstacle. He, like the angel of death, has an unpleasant job to do. In the book of Job, the Satan isn't against God at all. He's just one of the sons of God, and he asked permission to test Job and see how far this loyal servant of God will last if he has a lot of adversity. But in the story, he's very much under the control of God. What shocked me, surprised me, and intrigued me was that there was no such thing as a Satan in the sense that later Christendom came to know Satan. So that became a puzzle, and then I... You know, often when in the middle of work like this, you find something you don't expect at all. That's what I didn't expect. And so that became the focus of my work.
When in Christianity you have, you know, Jesus representing, you know, a force of good and Satan representing the force of evil, is that dichotomy, that clear division between good and evil, something new?
It looks new to me. I mean, I don't know where else to find it in the ancient world. I mean, even in the God of Israel, one finds wrath, one finds blessing. But in that dichotomy, I think it is new. It's an interesting question.
Elaine Pagels is my guest, and she's a historian of the ancient world. Her new book is called The Origin of Satan. You've been studying the ancient world, studying the history of religion for many years. And I actually want to broaden this discussion into some work that you did interpreting ancient texts that were discovered very recently, back in the mid-1940s. I believe they're known as the Nag Hammadi Library.
Yes, that's right.
Before we talk about their writings about Satan and evil, these are Gnostic texts. Would you explain what Gnostic texts are?
Yes, well, you know, agnostic means somebody who claims not to know about ultimate reality. A Gnostic is somebody who claims to have some knowledge, gnosis, is a Greek word for knowledge, but it doesn't mean intellectual knowledge. It doesn't mean like scientific knowledge or mathematical knowledge. It means a knowledge of relationship, like the kind of word you'd use do you know this person? Yes, I know that person. So it's a relational knowledge. I think maybe the word insight is better. So these are people who claim certain kinds of spiritual insight, but they also claim to be Christians who had insights particularly about Jesus and the disciples that were not given to everybody. In that find, there were 52 ancient texts that claim to go back to the beginning of the Christian era. There are gospels about Jesus. There are secret dialogues between him and disciples. There are letters from one apostle to another, the secret book of John, so forth.
Is it fair to call the Gnostics people who were more mystical in their approach?
They look very much like their writings certainly tend toward some kind of mystical understanding. I think they're also related to Jewish mysticism. But if you know Buddhism, you'll see a resonance there, as many people have.
Well, you've concluded that the Christianity may have been more diversified in its very early expressions than it is even today.
Well, I think it was, because when you look at these other Gospels, you find that the range of traditions about Jesus is just enormously fascinating and diverse and interesting. And the difference of point of view and perception and opinion is also enormous. That was very much cut down when the church became an organized structure that could agree on unified doctrine all over the world. That's a rather late phenomenon by my standards. It took about 150 years after the death of Jesus, anyway.
Well, give us a sense of what Christianity was like in that 150 years before things were codified.
There were little groups all over the ancient world, from Spain to Africa to what is now France or England, Italy, Greece, Asia Minor, Persia, with very different kinds of rituals, different kinds of beliefs, different kinds of practices. Some were radically ascetic and thought one had to live in celibacy and renunciation and be vegetarian and abstinent in terms of alcohol and meat, as well as sexuality. Others were completely different in their attitudes, and you can see them expressed in the Gospels of the New Testament. But so we have a picture of widely ranging sort of flourishing of a very diverse and interesting movement. What fascinated me was how that changed. And I think because of persecution by the state, it was necessary for many of these groups to consolidate and agree on what they believed and in a way become much more uniform.
You know what I find interesting? These ancient Gnostic texts that you helped interpret, you say that if they were found 1,000 years ago, they would have been destroyed as heretical.
Oh, they were.
Well, what was in them that would have been seen as heretical at the time?
Well, for one thing, some of them, as I say, have very different pictures of the God of Israel. I mean, some of them tell the story of Genesis as though the serpent were the divine voice, feminine divine voice, sometimes revealing the truth. And the God of Israel is sort of like an angry father who's wants to prevent Adam and Eve from waking up and participating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge and spiritual understanding. So there's a contest between this God and the benevolent serpent who's trying to free Adam and Eve from their bondage. That's one kind of thing. But also, and I think much more threatening to what became the emerging church, there are pictures of Jesus here that look much more like a Buddhist view. That is, Jesus not as the only Son of God through whom you must be saved, but Jesus as one who shows the way to the divine source. But what Jesus shows is that you can find the way to that divine source by yourself and within yourself. And to suggest that means that you may not need a priest, you may not need a church, you may not need Jesus for that matter. You just need to go off by yourself in the desert and struggle and meditate and contend with yourself until you find the deeper self within. And that was something that many church leaders thought was blasphemy, was deprecating to Jesus, and absolutely wrong.
My guest is Elaine Pagels. She's the author of the book The Gnostic Gospels and the new book The Origin of Satan. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elaine Pagel. She's the author of the new book, The Origin of Satan. You say that in these ancient texts, there's often expressed a belief, a celebration of God as both father and mother, as both male and female. What are some of the ways that's expressed?
Well, in the secret book of John, there's a remarkable opening of it in which John is grieving, the disciple John after the crucifixion is grieving because Jesus has been killed. And he says he suddenly sees that the earth is trembling and shaken, and there's a huge light, an earthly light shines, and in the light he sees changing forms. And then a voice comes from the light and says, John, John, why do you weep? I am the one who is with you always. I am the Father, I am the Mother, and I am the Son. Then John realizes that the one who's speaking is Jesus in his three forms. And of course, with the Trinity, you'd think, what is the Trinity? The Father, the Son, who would you expect to find there? I mean, not exactly a Holy Ghost. You'd expect to find Father, Mother, and Son. And that's what you find in these texts, partly because they go back to the Hebrew word for spirit, Holy Spirit. A feminine word in Hebrew, Ruach, would be interpreted as a divine mother. And so that is interpreted in many of these texts.
Do you find yourself more attracted to this early, more mystical, or more Buddha-like approach to Christianity?
I find myself very much attracted to it. Ever since I read those texts, I felt somehow that I was at home among these very strange flora and fauna. As I said, they are strange and wild, and my professors were saying, well, of course, you know, they're all blasphemy, and they're all heresy, and they're all quite ridiculous. And I was saying, you know, I love these texts, some of them. Some of them are funny. Some of them are sort of startling and unexpected. And others are just absolutely extraordinary. So, yes, I find myself very much attracted to them.
Tell us a little more what they are, when they're from, who wrote them.
We don't really know who wrote them. They probably come from about the 1st to the 3rd century. They're quite a diverse collection. The Gospel of Thomas looks like, and I think is, an early collection of Jesus' sayings. It may include some later sayings, but it's a very interesting early collection of the sayings of Jesus. Some of the ones I like very much are ones like this. Jesus says, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you." There are sayings like that that I found compelling as Zen koan.
Exactly. I mean, that's the kind of thing you can ponder for a very long time.
Yes, that's why I wrote the Gnostic Gospels, because of that saying. But there are many others. For example, there's a wonderful poem called Thunder, Perfect Mind, and this comes from the Greek word bronte, thunder, which was seen by the ancients, whether they were Jewish or Greek, as the voice of the divine. Here the divine voice speaks as a feminine power, and she speaks in a very extraordinary way of the opposites inherent in her contradictory nature, which comprise the whole of being. It's a marvelous poem.
I want to get back to what you say helped to inspire your new book, The Origin of Satan. I mean, you lost your husband, and it was a horrible experience. It made you feel like you were living with kind of his invisible presence even after he died, and you were wondering about the invisible world and the meaning of good and evil and why good things happen, why bad things happen to good people, and so on. So you thought a lot about Satan and expressions of Satan. I'm sure you kept returning to the early Gnostic Gospels as well. Did you get different explanations that came to you through studying both?
Well,
I mean, explanations of how what could have happened to your family happened.
I found that explanations had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. Explanations weren't useful. You know, it's like the mind, I found that my mind kept looking for some interpretation of what happened. And then the interpretation would just shatter on with the absolute facts of what had happened. You know, just this happened. That's, the interpretations were quite secondary, and they didn't help me very much at all. But I do find in some of these sources, and particularly actually in the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Philip, understandings about existence which are helpful.
I don't know how religious a person you are, or how much your interest in religion is a purely historical, intellectual one. Did you find any comfort in religion?
Well, I started this search of religion as somebody who had come from a sort of liberal but not particularly religious Protestant background. In fact, you know, brought up to think that religion was really for uneducated people and not educated people like ourselves. Kind of snobbish view that you get in academic circles. And I found I was completely fascinated by religion from the time I was quite young. I mean, I loved all kinds of poetry and dance and music. I mean, every kind you can imagine. I know you explore many kinds. But there was something about, say, religious music or dance or architecture or poetry that I just found particularly compelling. And often it was Christian, sometimes it was Hopi or Buddhist or something else. However, because this is the culture that I live with and was brought up with, it was what engages me very deeply.
Do you participate in any religious rituals, or is it a more intellectual pursuit?
Well, I do now. I didn't used to, but I've been going to various kinds of meditation practice, sometimes to the Quaker meeting house in Princeton, to the Episcopal Church there, which has an extraordinary liturgy. There are a group of Roman Catholic monks whose worship is very deep and powerful and means a great deal to me as well.
Part of what we turn to religion for is, I think, not only to explain things to ourselves, but also to explain things to children. I know you have children, and you lost your husband. You also lost a six-year-old son a few years ago.
Yes.
To illness. Did you find yourself turning to religion at all to help explain these losses to your children?
Well, let me say this. What I was trying to say before is that it doesn't seem to me it helps much to try to explain these losses. One has to live with them, even though we can't explain them. At least I can't explain them. One has to live with them. And in living with them, living with the fact that they've happened, that they do happen, and they're not unusual, there I found meditation, for example, and prayer to be essential. And I've brought my children into that process because I think it's going to be essential for them as well in understanding, you know, how we can deal with our lives. So when I say it's not useful for explaining, I mean something kind of intellectual by explaining. You know, the mental explanation doesn't help me very much. But in living with some reality like that, I find these religious means essential.
What are your most fulfilling experiences in a place of worship?
That's an interesting question. That's an interesting question. Or outside of a place of worship, I would say hiking up in the mountains is one of them. Sitting in meditation with other people who deeply know how to do that. I was thinking of a monastery in Colorado, which is an extraordinary depth to it as a place to meditate. So, and the third would be the extraordinary music that comes out of Christian tradition, particularly for me. Some amazing music that I very much love.
You mentioned hiking in the mountains, and if you don't mind my mentioning
this,
I know your husband died in a hiking accident.
Yes.
And the fact that you would continue to hike and to feel that was among your most spiritual experiences is really interesting. I mean, a lot of people would just be afraid to set foot on rocky slopes again after.
Well, that may be, but it was very much a kind of spiritual home that we shared, and I feel that those mountains are a remarkable place. When I do hike, I hike on trails and in places which have no drop-off. I don't take chances with my life because I know that sometimes, you know, we don't get a second chance with those things, and I have my children to be responsible to, and my husband and the whole family.
Elaine Pagels, she's the author of the new book, The Origin of Satan. She's a professor of religion at Princeton University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to music from Carl Denson's new CD, Chunky Pecan Pie. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review. And we meet Rusty Cundiff, the director, co-writer, and co-star of the urban horror film Tales from the Hood. He spoofed gangster rap in his previous film, Fear of a Black Hat. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Supreme Court has ruled that student-athletes can be made to take drug tests, even if they aren't suspected of using drugs. The case stems from an Oregon boy who was barred from a football team for refusing to take a drug test. A lower court ruled for him, saying the testing was unreasonable, since he wasn't suspected of using drugs. The High Court disagreed by a margin of 6-3. It says student-athletes cannot expect the same kind of privacy. In a second action, the justices set aside an appeals court ruling against student-led prayers at public school graduations. They say the case from Idaho is moot, since the graduation has already been held. The ruling is not the last word on the matter. 2 years ago, the High Court left intact an appellate court ruling from Texas permitting student-led invocations and benedictions at graduations. Congressional Democrats plan to spend much of this week criticizing the Republicans' budget plan. Observers say their effort will be futile. UPI's Pi Chamberlain prepared this report.
Senate Democratic Leader Daschle says Democrats will work to portray the budget as a massive handout to the wealthy that cuts programs for the poor and the elderly and programs including education and welfare. But he said none of the Democratic criticism will have any practical effect because since the Republicans control the Congress, Democrats have to realize that when it comes to the budget...
First, it'll pass. Secondly, it'll pass with our extraordinary objections.
Congress is expected to begin considering the budget Thursday and to pass it Thursday or Friday. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Despite the administration's expression of concern, the chairman of the Base Closure and Realignment Commission says he expects the president to approve the list of military base closures. Lester Graham of member station KWMU in St. Louis reports.
Statements by administration officials over the weekend suggest President Clinton is considering rejecting the list because of the heavy political cost in California. That state would be hit hard by the closures, and it is seen as key in Mr. Clinton's reelection bid next year. But the chairman of the Base Closure Commission, former Illinois Senator Alan Dixon, says the president expressed no concerns to commission members during their deliberations.
I have to say I would be somewhat surprised if anything was done other than approving it and sending it back.
The president must accept or reject the base closing recommendations in their entirety. For National Public Radio, this is Lester Graham in St. Louis.
There's some confusion about how many people were killed today in today's assassination attempt on Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. The attack was carried out in Ethiopia, and officials there say two attackers and two Ethiopian security guards were killed. But officials from the Organization of African Unity say the four people who died were all attackers. On Wall Street, stock prices were lower today. The Dow lost 34 points. This is NPR. The lawyer for the Oklahoma City bombing suspect says his client, Timothy McVeigh, was bound by court rules when asked by Newsweek magazine if he was guilty. Lawyer Stephen Jones told TV news programs this morning that McVeigh could only state his intended innocent plea or he could have faced contempt of court charges. The Newsweek reporter who interviewed McVeigh told ABC he was surprised by McVeigh's demeanor. He says he expected to find McVeigh a monster. Instead, he says he found a very bright, amiable guy. A new report supports President and Mrs. Clinton's explanation of their involvement in the Whitewater affair. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports from New York.
According to the Wall Street Journal, the report submitted to the Resolution Trust Corporation confirms the First Family's contention that the Clintons were passive investors in Whitewater Development Corporation. The journal cites anonymous sources who have read the report who say it indicates the Clintons had no financial involvement in Whitewater until 1986, as the Clintons have claimed. It's been alleged that money transferred from Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan to Whitewater before 1986 was a contributing factor in the Arkansas Thrift's collapse. The report was authored by the law firm of Jay Stevens, a Republican who has been critical of President Clinton. White House aides had expressed dismay when Stevens was retained to investigate civil liability connected to Madison's collapse. The report tends to verify the Clintons' estimate of how much they lost in the Whitewater venture, $47,000. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
Election officials in Haiti are counting ballots after yesterday's confusing elections. The country's first local and legislative elections in some 5 years were marked by chaos and disorganization, even some death threats. Many polling stations opened late or not at all. But the U.S. National Security Advisor says despite chaos, it's amazing that many people got to vote. The elections were the first since a U.S.-led force propelled ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide back into power. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rusty Cundiff, is a stand-up comic turned actor and filmmaker. He spoofed gangster rap in last year's film Fear of a Black Hat. Cundiff wrote himself the leading role as Ice Cold. He co-wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new film Tales from the Hood, starring Clarence Williams, David Alan Grier, and Corbin Burnson. Tales from the Hood is an urban horror film with a comic edge. All the supernatural stuff happens in the context of urban realities, like drug dealing, racism, police corruption, and child abuse. I asked Cundiff how he came up with the idea.
Well, I was a horror film fan of sorts, and I had written a play called The Black Horror Show, which was kind of a takeoff of the whole idea of the disease lycanthropy, which is the disease of being a werewolf. And I had a character who had the disease of blackanthropy. And during Black History Month, he turned into a Black Panther, kind of a Huey Newton, you know, leather jacket wearing, fist raised Black Panther. And I wanted to originally transfer that to film. And it was a short, so I figured that I'd have to put a couple of pieces with it. And as I started to work on that and got involved with Darren Scott, who was a producer and co-writer of the film, went more towards making the action a little bit more scary and less kind of farcical, which it was in the play. And as we worked on that, I really start to think, you know, what is it that really scares me? Because I go to horror films and ghost films, and they really don't ever scare me because, you know, I've never had the experience of a ghost trying to take my wallet on the street, or, you know, I've never been worried about a ghost passing me in a drive-by or denying me a job because I was black or female or, well, I haven't been female, but you get my point. So that's kind of where that idea came from. I said, you know, the things that scare me are the things that I really worry about, that people do to people and that, you know, affect me when I walk out of the house every day and I'm driving in my car and so on.
In Tales from the Hood, you cast Clarence Williams as an undertaker. What did you know him from? Did you know him from the Mod Squad years or from movies?
Yeah, I knew Clarence from the Mod Squad years and, you know, many other things after that. But I guess my first recollection of him was as Lincoln Hayes III on the Mod Squad. And, you know, as a young black kid in, I don't know, what was that, 1960-something, early 70s, I guess it was. But he was, you know, the first black role model that I could remember on TV that was serious and, you know, kind of manly in a just a very direct and honest way. And, you know, I spent a lot of afternoons after school riding around on my bicycle pretending to be Lincoln Hayes.
Your previous film, Fear of a Black Hat, was a parody of rap music. And were you or are you a big rap fan?
Actually, I like rap a good deal. I don't listen to it as much as I used to, but I don't do anything other than work as much as I used to. But yes, I am a rap fan.
Before we talk more about that film, which is on video, let me play one of the parodies that isn't actually in the film, but you made a video, I guess, shortly after the film was released.
Okay.
This is a parody of Snoop Doggy Dogg's most famous song. Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
It was just kind of a crazy whim. I knew that Fear of a Black Hat was coming out kind of late from the point where we had actually finished filming it, and I wanted to add something that would kind of pull it up, you know, to date a little bit. And so Snoop Doggy Dogg is, you know, was the hottest thing And his song was the hottest thing, so we just went for that.
And the group is called?
Oh, it's Ice Froggy Frog with NWH.
And you are Ice?
I'm Ice.
Okay. Here's the parody.
Ribbit, yeah, this is Ice Froggy Frog, and this is a little song for all the polywogs and the tadpoles from the Big Frog. To the pond, back to the top, Ice Froggy Frog jumping, and I got the drop. It's solo in that grass, tadpoles will sing. Long reach to the spot where my tongue will fling. Hipping and hopping, hopping and hipping, but don't lose your sleep. 9-4's easier for me to buck up the sheets. And I ain't hold nothing back, and I'm about to yank 9 from a gunny sack. It's like that, and as a matter of fact,
sling your tongue back,
cause I never hesitate to give a dragonfly smack.
So hop through the sands a bit, you see that it's a must be hop long.
What's my name, fool? Sang. It's the frog to the log, hipping and hopping, ribbing and
all. And that's Rusty Cundiff on lead there on his parody of Snoop Doggy Dog. That's really fun. What are some of the absurdities of rap that you wanted to lampoon in your movie?
Well, there were a lot of things, actually. And it was strange because at a certain level there are certain things, two certains in one sentence, now five. but there are things within rap that I really feel are important, and then there are other things that you kind of go, well, this is kind of silly. Gangster rap, for example, I mean, I don't doubt. In fact, I know that there are certain rappers who have lived certain lifestyles, and they talk about them, and that part is very real. But there's also the phenomenon of, you know, once something starts making a lot of money, people want to jump on the bandwagon. So you have, you know, gangster rappers that have never been gangsters. You have people saying how many people they've killed that have never even beat anyone up, probably. It becomes... You know, and that's okay if you take it for what it is, which is just entertainment. I like gangster rap as much as I like, you know, going to see The Godfather or watching Scarface and seeing Al Pacino shoot up, you know, 100 people in a film. And to me, gangster rap is the same kind of entertainment release. It's a very, I mean, you know, excuse the expression, macho, male-oriented, let's go out and take care of all our problems by pulling out a gun, and, you know, and that's the way we're going to deal with it. But that is very common in a lot of our entertainment from books and literature and films. So to have that in music and rap seems like a logical step. The problem is, and one of the things that I didn't deal with as much as I would have liked to in the film, the problem is that people take this medium, this particular music, as being something that is supposed to be absolutely real, absolutely a total reflection of a group of people and who they are and where they come from, and that just isn't the case. I don't expect that Eddie Van Halen, you know, runs around in spandex all day at home. And you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yes.
People have stage personas. And I think the problem is these rappers, some of them have taken their stage persona beyond because they think that they're supposed to.
So tell me who you made NWH into, that stands for Niggers with Hats.
Right.
So what was their persona on and off stage?
Well, Niggers with Hats was a combination of a lot of different personalities, I think, that are within the rap community. Ice Cold, who was the leader of NWH, the main character in NWH, he was kind of part Chuck D and part Humpty Hump from Digital Underground, which are two very... opposite characters. I mean, Chuck D is very extremely political, and Humpty Hump is like the leader of silly within the hip-hop community, as far as I can tell. And then there was Tasty Taste, who is a kind of a combination of, at the time, Eazy-E and Flavor Flav. Once again, two very opposite type characters. Flavor Flav, the kind of very flamboyant showman of with Chuck D, and then Eazy-E, who was, you know, the original gangster from Compton. So those two combined together, and then Tone Deaf, who was a little bit Prince B, who people might know, and a little bit, I guess, maybe Tone Loc. So we kind of played around with a lot of things, and just the different attitudes of the groups.
Then, of course, you have your Vanilla Ice character, who you named Ice Sherbert, who's the white wannabe, who's always, like, down with the rappers.
Yeah, the Vanilla Sherbert character. He, in fact, that actor, Damon Kevany, I think his name is very, very funny and just did a fantastic job with that. But we wanted to lampoon all of the different aspects of the music and the fact that these guys generally all had, they had a lot of white managers and influence from white record executives on a form of musical expression that, as I was saying earlier, is perceived to be such a true reflection of the young urban black community. In fact, when we were shopping our soundtrack for NWH, we approached a label in New York, Tommy Boy, that met with the president out here, and he liked the music, he liked the film, and he said, but, you know, I got to get this back to my my girl in New York, who is, you know, she's my ear on the street, she knows what's happening in the black community, what all the young black kids are into, and I don't know that, because, you know, I'm not that, but if you could go back there, and I'll let her listen to this, and we'll play it for her, and she'll tell me if this is right for us. And so I'm expecting to go back to New York and meet some probably 20-something-year-old black woman who probably went to college, but, you know, maybe she's just very smart. Anyhow, the thing is, we get back there, and it was like a 30-plus white lady, and she was the one who was deciding what was urban and black and cutting edge. And I said, wow, this is very interesting. You know, I mean, I don't know where she studied to get those credentials to be able to do that. And she was obviously picking the areas of black life that were interesting and intriguing to her. It was a very voyeuristic mm-hmm. thing. It was, I'm very interested in this area. These gangster guys, they're really interesting, and wow, that is really kind of odd and different. But the more normal parts of black life kind of get pushed to the side.
My guest is Rusty Cundiff, and his latest film is called Tales from the Hood, and it's an urban horror film. And why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Rusty Cundiff is my guest. He co-wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new film Tales from the Hood, an urban horror film. Now, I know you had a small part in Robert Townsend's satire Hollywood Shuffle, which was largely about how there was no place in Hollywood for African-American actors and all the kind of stereotypes that they were offered. Did you go through experiences like that yourself when you were getting started, before you started writing your own films?
Yeah, I think almost all black performers out here have stories like that. Absolutely. I mean, you would go in and I used to do a joke in my act where I would say, you know, that I would go in and I'd read something, because you go in, you audition, you read part of the scene, and they'd say, well, can you do it a little bit, you know, more, give us a little more, you know, a little bit more ethnic? And I'd go, what, you want me to do it like this? You know? And that was always a little thing I did. But yeah, you would get that. You'd get, you know, can you be a little bit more black? You know, just a little bit more, you know.
Let me ask you. I live near a twin movie theater. And often what happens is, in one of the screens, a movie with a white cast is playing, and in the next screen, a movie with a black cast is playing. And so there's lots of white and black people online, and you can just virtually tell before anyone buys their ticket what they're going to buy it to. The white people can go to the white film, and the black people can go to the black film. I mean, the person who sells the tickets almost doesn't even need to ask. And, you know, and I find that really depressing. And I wonder if you think that's kind of true in the film world in general, if that's if you see a lot of that.
I think in terms of what whites go to see versus what blacks go to see, I think blacks will see a larger variety only because we've been conditioned to see more, because there haven't always been as many black films as there are now, and subject matter for black films is still relatively narrow. So, you know, I'll go see Braveheart, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm planning on seeing. But I'll go see Braveheart, and when I go to see it, I will probably project myself into the image of the hero, Mel Gibson. You know, I'll identify with that character. So now, when white audiences go to see black films, this is just my own personal theory. I believe they go, as I was saying before, out of a slightly voyeuristic, in a voyeuristic mentality. But, you know, they're not used to going to a movie and saying, there's the protagonist, and that's who I see myself as, that protagonist, and, oh, that protagonist is black. But that doesn't bother me. They wouldn't go to see a movie, you know, like that as easily, because they're not used to projecting themselves onto a black face. And black people are totally used to projecting themselves onto white faces when they go to movies. You know, my girlfriend will go, she'll be Meryl Streep for the hour and a half, and I'll be, you know, I'll be whoever. But, you know, I don't know how many white people go to a film and become Danny Glover for that hour, or become, you know, even Denzel or you know, Eddie. It's more of, look at that, isn't that interesting?
Rusty Cundiff. He co-wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new film Tales from the Hood. His spoof of gangster rap, Fear of a Black Hat, is on video. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on today's Supreme Court ruling?
Hi, Terry. The court has said that public schools may force student-athletes to undergo drug testing. If you want to play sports, you could be tested. Nina Totenberg has that story, and Linda Wertheimer will talk with a couple of high school principals on the matter. SUNY Khalid reports on the assassination attempt against Egypt's President Mubarak. Trevor Rowe has a report on the growth over a 50-year period of the United Nations, and Daniel Shore has some thoughts on the effectiveness of the UN. Also, I'll talk with David Hackworth of Newsweek magazine, who interviewed Timothy McVeigh, accused in the Oklahoma City bombing. And Mike Schuster reports on the search in Chechnya for Fred Cuny, relief expert who disappeared in April.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Southern California saxophonist Carl Denson toured for years backing singer Lenny Kravitz and now leads a funk band called the Gray Boy All-Stars. In the last 3 years, Denson has also recorded 3 straight-ahead jazz albums. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, for a guy who only discovered bebop in the mid-1980s, Denson sounds all right.
Tenor saxophonist Carl Denson playing his Waltz for Leslie. It's from his new album, Chunky Pecan Pie. Denson obviously likes his food. His previous records were called Blackened Red Snapper and Herbal Turkey Breast. He records for Minor Music, a German label which has a habit of making good jazz records by R&B horn players, notably James Brown alumni Maceo Parker, Fred Wesley, and Pee Wee Ellis. kind of a gimmick, but it works. Carl Denson's pop music experience makes him appreciate a strong melodic hook and improvising that stays connected to the melody, no matter how busy his solos get. Here's some more of Waltz for Leslie. Carl Denson gets a conspicuous boost from his East Coast rhythm section, bassist Dave Holland and drummer Jack DeJohnette. Like most tenor saxophonists who front a pianoless trio, Denson sounds indebted to Sonny Rollins, who put such trios on the map, and whose influence becomes ever greater as the 90s roll on. For decades, the dominant influence on saxophonists was John Coltrane, but the open-ended modal improvising he epitomized has fallen out of fashion. Rollins' investigations of song forms is better suited to 90s neoconservatism. He's esteemed for giving an improvisation thematic unity, for taking a kernel of melody and developing it. You can hear echoes of that method and of his brawny sound in Denson's playing. That tune is Dexter Gordon's Fried Bananas. What is it with Carl Denson and food? He's also got tunes on this record called Blue Eyed Peas and Banana Boy. I'll say one thing for him. He's making me hungry. I gotta go grab an early dinner. I'll see ya.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Chunky Pecan Pie featuring saxophonist Carl Denson on the Minor label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Kenesha Baker is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.